A reading from the book of Genesis. Now Joseph was taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, brought him from the Ishmaelites, who had brought him down there. Yahweh was with Joseph, and he became a successful man. He was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that Yahweh was with him, and that that Yahweh caused all that he did to prosper in his hands. So Joseph found favor in his sight and attended him. He made him overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had. From the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, Yahweh blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of Yahweh was on all that he had in house and field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's charge. And with him there, he had no concern for anything but the food that he ate. Now Joseph was handsome and good-looking, and after a time his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Look, with me here my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my hand. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except yourself, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" And although she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not consent to lie beside her or be with her. One day, however, when he went into the house to do his work, and while no one else was in the house, she caught hold of his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. When she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled outside, she called out to the members of her household and said to them, "See, my husband has brought among us a Hebrew to insult us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And when he heard me raise my voice and cry out, he left his garment beside me and fled outside." Then she kept his garment by her until his master came home, and she told him the same story, saying, "The Hebrew servant whom you have brought among us came in to insult me. But as soon as I raised my voice and cried out, he left his garment beside me and fled outside." When his master heard the words that his wife spoke to him, saying, "This is the way your servant treated me," he became enraged. And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. He remained there in prison, but Yahweh was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love. He gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. The chief jailer committed to Joseph's care all the prisoners who were in the prison, and whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The chief jailer paid no heed to anything that was in Joseph's care, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, Yahweh made it prosper. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Thanks be God. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Matthew. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. The Gospel of Christ.
Now, if you recall last week, I talked about the variety of labels that have been given, the various names that can be used to describe the descendants of Israel. We began with the understanding that Noah had a son named Shem, and so all of his descendants would be Shemites or Semites or Semitic. One of them is Abraham. He had a son named Isaac, and then Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, and so all of his descendants are called Israelites. And then during the time of the exile and afterwards, because they were returning to an area now known as the province of Yehud or Judah, they became known as Jews, and that label is still used today. And then today, anybody who's a citizen of Israel is an Israeli. There's another label that was to be included in the list that I didn't mention last week, but it came up today, and that is the label of Hebrew. Here in the story, we hear that Joseph is referred to as the Hebrew. And where that word comes from is from an ancient Sumerian word, abiru, is our best educated guess, which basically means nomad. And so it first appears in the scriptures in Genesis chapter 14. Abraham has made his journey from Ur through Haran and is now in Canaan. But of course, this isn't his own land yet. He's just passing through. So in Genesis 14, he is referred to as Abram the Hebrew. Abram the Hebrew. So he's given this descriptive title. This is Abram the nomad. This is Abram the guy who's just passing through, the guy who doesn't have a home. And then the second time it appears is now after we've had some descendants, and here they already had started to gain a label with Abraham in mind, and even though we're now two generations along, even three generations, that label sticks, and that's what Joseph is called. You will see the word Hebrew continue to be used. In fact, it's the name of the language that the Israelites would speak. And it even appears again in the New Testament. But for the most part, the label Hebrew happens until they are no longer nomads. So once we get to 1000 BCE, when the kingdom of Israel has been established under a single king and they're all united and they're settled in there, you don't see the term Hebrew used quite as much. They are now definitely Israelites because they're part of the kingdom of Israel. So yes, another label, and all of that isn't even part of this sermon. That's just there for free. Now let's start the sermon. What we heard today in Genesis 39 was part of the story of Joseph. And the story of Joseph is something that is well known, and it's been told in many different ways, in both print and in movies. Some of you might have taken in Andrew Lloyd Webber's musical, Joseph in the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. I think it was Andrew Lloyd Webber, right? Yeah. Anyway, it's a really popular story, and part of the reason it's so popular is because there's so much detail in it. And there are all the classic elements of storytelling. There's a character that we follow, there's conflict, there's resolution, there's suspense, and all of these things, and ultimately a happy ending. But one might wonder why it is that the story of Joseph factors in so significantly in the Bible. After all, it starts in chapter 37 and goes all the way to chapter 50, which is the end of the book of Genesis. And it might seem kind of strange that it's such a big part. Well, what we have to keep in mind is that it isn't really the story of Joseph. It's actually the story of Jacob, his father, the story of Israel. Because throughout the Bible, Yahweh will say that he is the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And Abraham is introduced in chapter 12, and we start hearing the story of Abraham. And then in chapter 21, Isaac is born, and we start getting the story of Isaac. Then in chapter 25, Jacob is born, and we start getting the story of Jacob. And what Genesis is doing, and the writers in 1000 BCE putting this all together, are making sure that the people that are reading this text can see how Yahweh, the God of Israel, has been faithful all the way through these years, going back to the three great patriarchs. Here's what Yahweh was doing with Abraham, here's what Yahweh was doing with Isaac, and here's how Yahweh is being faithful to Jacob/Israel and all of his descendants. And so part of that half of the book of Genesis includes this part that features Joseph as a significant character. So who was Joseph? Well, Joseph was Jacob's 11th son. It was also his most favorite son. And Jacob made it really clear that Joseph was his favorite son, and Joseph knew he was the favorite son. And we're introduced to him when he's 17 years old, knowing he's the favorite, thinking on his brothers, and just basically being unwise. Because when you have 10 older brothers and you annoy them like that, you're asking for endless noogies at very, very least, and we're going to find out it gets worse. But why is it that Joseph had this pride of place among this family of 12 brothers? Well, it's a bit of a soap opera. And so Jacob, when it was time for him to find a wife, fell in love with Rachel, and he wanted to marry Rachel. But Rachel's father, Jacob's uncle, insisted that Jacob had to marry his older daughter, the older sister of Rachel, Leah, had to marry her first. So he marries Leah, and then after 7 years, he gets to marry Rachel. And then finally, he gets to leave and set up house on his own, and Jacob's uncle makes sure that Leah has a handmaid named Zilpah, And Rachel has a handmaiden named Bilhah to help everybody out, make sure things work out well. So we have these four women now. Two of them are married to Jacob and two of them are not. Leah is able to have kids and produces four children for Jacob: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. And all of those names basically mean something like, ha ha ha, God loves me more than Rachel. And it's really funny. All the names of the tribes of Israel are related to this interplay between Rachel and Leah. So Leah is able to give four children, and then she can't have any more kids. But Rachel can't have kids at all. And so she's really despondent and really jealous of her older sister. So she says to Jacob, you know what? Why don't you sleep with my handmaid Bilhah, and she will produce children for me, for you. And so Jacob says, okay. And he sleeps with Bilhah, and she produces two children for him. Well, Leah is saying, oh yeah, I can do that too. And so she tells Jacob to sleep with her handmaid Zilpah, who produces two children for Jacob as well. So now we're up to eight kids. And then it says that Yahweh opens Leah's womb again because she was the unloved wife, and she's able to produce two more kids for Jacob. And so now there are 10 kids, and Rachel still hasn't been able to have any children. By the way, this very episode is the inspiration for Margaret Atwood's book, The Handmaid's Tale. This is exactly where it comes from. Anyway, so Rachel, finally, God remembers Rachel and opens her womb, and her first son is Joseph. The 11th son. We'll have another one, Benjamin, a bit later on. But Joseph was finally the son that was born to the woman that Jacob had wanted to marry all along, and that's why he ends up being the favorite. Well, with his immaturity and Jacob's lack of wisdom in playing favorites, it ultimately comes to a head, and his 10 brothers decide, you know what, we just got to get rid of this guy, but we can't kill him, so let's just sell him. So they sold him to this trader caravan that made their way down to Egypt. Then they made up a story to basically make their dad think that he got killed by a wild animal. And so now Jacob is despondent, and he's lost his favorite son and can't be consoled, but what do you do? That's what happens. So meanwhile, Joseph makes it to Egypt with this trading caravan, and a man named Potiphar, the captain of the guard, purchases him as a slave. And now this is Joseph's life. This is what he's doing now. Okay, I'm a slave. But in this passage that we heard Susan read, we hear four times the statement that Yahweh was with Joseph. That appears four times in the one chapter. Yahweh was with Joseph, which makes it a significant theme for us to continue to keep in mind, especially since it invokes the name Yahweh. Because once again, remember, this name of the God of Israel has not yet been revealed. That comes in the next book. But because this has been compiled, you know, centuries after the events that are being described, they have rewritten Yahweh's name back into the story so that the readers in the kingdom of Israel can see why it's good for a nation to have Yahweh as their God. Because look, it was Yahweh all along who was making stuff happen, not only for Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, but even through this son named Joseph. Yahweh is taking care of us. Now, in the rest of the story, Yahweh's name doesn't show up. We just go back to God, or Elohim in Hebrew, or El Shaddai, God Almighty, appears a couple of times. And that is the title that Joseph would have used in referring to God. So he's now a slave, but he just gets to it. He's evidently a man of a certain kind of character. He's aware of God. We don't ever read about Joseph praying to God. That never happens in the story. We don't see Joseph making any sacrifices to God or even worshiping God, but he knows that God is present, and he's aware of the presence of God. And so when Potiphar's wife sees that this guy looks really good and she wants to sleep with him and he refuses, part of the reason why he refuses is he says, I can't. You already are Potiphar's wife, the master who's entrusted everything to me except you, and I'm not going to do this wicked thing and I'm not going to sin against God. So he's aware of the presence of God and wants to keep that in mind. This unfortunately gets him into trouble. Potiphar's wife, as you heard, frames him and he gets thrown into prison over something he didn't do. In fact, he was being a man of character, and it got him into prison. So now as the story continues, he's there for a while, but he encounters two men, two of them who work for Pharaoh, the leader of Egypt. One of them is the cook for Pharaoh, or a chef, and the other one is essentially the butler. And so these two men, and by the way, Joseph, just like when he was working with Potiphar, was given great responsibility, had also been given responsibility by the jailer to take care of things. And so now these two men are troubled, and they talk to Joseph, and Joseph says, what's the matter? And they said, well, we've had dreams, and we don't know what is happening with these things, like what they mean or whatever. And Joseph says, well, God's the one who gives interpretations to dreams, so tell me what your dreams were. And so they tell him their two dreams. And Joseph says, okay, well, first of all, to the cook, I've got some bad news for you. In 3 days, you're dead. To you, the butler, I've got good news for you. In 3 days, you're going to get hired back by the Pharaoh. 3 days elapse, and sure enough, the cook loses his head, and the butler is restored. And when he's going back to Pharaoh's palace, Joseph says, please remember me. Will you tell the Pharaoh I'm here unjustly? Get me out of here, please, I beg of you. And the butler says, sure, no problem, I'll do that. And then he promptly forgets all about Joseph. Joseph spends 13 years in prison. And then finally, Pharaoh has a couple of dreams, and he doesn't know what they mean, but he's sure they mean something, and his magicians can't figure it out. And that's when the butler goes, oh yeah, there was this guy I was in prison with 10 years ago or something, and he could interpret dreams. Maybe he can help out here. So he arranges for Pharaoh to come and meet Joseph, and Pharaoh says to Joseph, I understand you can interpret dreams. And Joseph says, look, it's not me, it's God, okay? But let me know what your dreams are, because I would like to tell you what's going on then. You know, we'll see what God tells me about that. And so Pharaoh tells his two dreams. There are seven fat cows that get eaten up by seven skinny cows. There are seven big ears of corn that are eaten up by seven scrawny ears of corn. And Joseph says, okay, here's what's going on. There's going to be 7 years of plenty and bountiful harvest, and then 7 years of famine. So what you got to do is get someone who's smart in place to make sure they put all the extra stuff in storage so that when the 7 years of famine come, we can actually feed our people. And Pharaoh says, well, it's pretty obvious that the Spirit of God is in you, so you're going to be my guy. And just like that, Joseph becomes the number two guy in all of Egypt. And he oversees the 7 years of plenty and makes sure that things are stored up. And then when the 7 years of famine come, now the Egyptians can come to Pharaoh's headquarters and Joseph can be giving them rations from the stored up food. But it turns out that this famine happens all over the world, which essentially means the Middle East, the world effectively for that area. And people from outside Egypt were able to come to Egypt and find food as well because the famine was affecting them too. And this included Joseph's brothers, Joseph's family. The Israelites had to come to Egypt because they were suffering from the famine. And so this allowed them family to be reunited once again. And the way it all pans out is ultimately all 70 of Joseph's family members are able to come down to Egypt and find food and be well taken care of, and the line of Israel is preserved. That's the story of Joseph. And the intention behind that was that the readers would go and see, look, we see that Yahweh is indeed faithful, that Yahweh was with Joseph through all of that, and on top of that, Yahweh was making sure we were preserved. In the story, on two occasions, Joseph says to his brothers, because they're feeling guilty about what they did so many years ago, he says to them, don't worry about it. You didn't sell me into slavery to get me into Egypt. God got me into Egypt. It was God all along. And then he says on a second occasion, what you intended for evil, God intended for good. And so Joseph is saying, this entire scenario has all been under God's sovereign, masterful plan. And all of this is in place for the purpose of preserving our lineage. Because if I wasn't here to be the second in command in Egypt, then when the famine came, nobody would have been here to preserve my family, the Israelites. And the readers of that story would be left thinking, all right, it makes sense to pay attention to Yahweh because Yahweh is in charge of everything. This is good. I would suggest to you that it's not as good as it sounds. And with that, I'll take a drink of water to let the heresy sink in. But what I mean is this. Joseph's claim And the whole point of the story is that this was God's doing all along. So, the idea that there would be such sibling rivalry that Joseph's brothers would sell him was part of God's plan. That he would be sold to Potiphar so that he could be framed by Potiphar's wife and end up in prison was part of God's plan. Because that's where he would meet these two men who would have dreams, which would then ultimately allow him to get in touch with Pharaoh when Pharaoh has a dream was all part of God's plan. So that when it became apparent that there would be 7 years of plenty, Joseph could be in the right place to store up all the excess food, so that when the 7 years of famine came, there would actually be food there. That this is what the picture is. I think you would agree. What you intended for evil, God intended for good. It wasn't you who sent me down to Egypt. It was God who sent me to Egypt. And this is how he did it for this purpose. Here's the problem. And this is what we have to wrestle with in reading this today. When Joseph gets to talk to Pharaoh and answer Pharaoh's question about what his dreams mean, Joseph says, Pharaoh's dreams are one and the same. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. God's going to reveal what God is about to do. He says it again. It is as I told Pharaoh, God has shown to Pharaoh what God is about to do. And so what is God about to do? God is going to bring 7 years of bountiful harvest, and then he's going to bring 7 years of famine. This was God's intention and plan and purpose. So if all of this started 13 years earlier, in order to make sure that Israel could survive the famine, why is it that God even brought the famine in the first place? Like, isn't the easier way to preserve the people of Israel is to not have them go through a famine? And yet, the story is that God was going to bring the famine. And so God was planning ahead. So 20 years earlier, he's arranging for Joseph to be sold so that he ends up being in the second most highest place in Egypt, so that when the famine comes that God is bringing, God will provide a way for Israel to be preserved. Not to mention that if it's famine, it means that there are people who didn't make it, that there are people who would have starved, because that's what happens in a famine, that there are animals that would have starved. We had our blessing of the animal service today, and some animals got written off because God brought a famine. What on earth do we do with this? Why would God bring out a famine at all? And why for 7 years? Well, here's the thing. What we have to remind ourselves about what we read here is that this is from 3,000 to 4,000 years old. And the understanding back then about how God operated is, first of all, God did everything, right? If there was a windstorm, God did it. If it rained, God did it. If there was an earthquake, God did it. If there was a bountiful harvest, God did it. If there was a famine, God did it. And so that's just the automatic assumption. Now, different peoples, different nations would disagree with which God was responsible, but that's the idea. God simply did all these things. So if there was going to be a famine coming, well, we have no choice. It's God who does that. But it seems that there hadn't been a thinking through of what the implications are for the entire story. See, the point that is being made is that Yahweh preserves Yahweh's people. And that's another part of the story. Every nation had its own God. And so if there were other people who perished in the famine, that doesn't matter. Because what we care about is the Israelites being preserved by Yahweh. Whatever Marduk was doing with his Babylonian people and whatever Baal was doing with his Canaanite people doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if they died, that's fine. Maybe they made their way to Egypt and got some food, that's great. But the point is, Yahweh preserves Israel. And that is the narrow focus of the story. But in trying to say that God was responsible for all of it, unfortunately, now that we have moved on several thousand years from the origin of this story, where we have come to understand that there really is one divine presence, not several different gods over different nations, this narrative becomes problematic. Because we can no longer tolerate the idea that there's just one God only looking out for a particular people. because God is the one in whom we all live and move and have our being. The God that we worship, that Jesus called his Father, the God called Yahweh in the Hebrew Bible, we have since discovered is the God over all things. So how is it that this God could decide, I'll let some people starve, but I'll have this elaborate plan just to show how faithful I am to preserve one people? What's happening here, I think, is we're seeing the brilliance of our scriptures in that we are getting a picture of how God is understood to be from ancient times all the way through to the time of Christ. And then since then, our understanding of God has continued. We have seen that Jesus will say, you understood God to be saying this, but I'm telling you it's actually this way. And he changes the story. What do we do with the book of the story of Jacob, in particular the story of Joseph within it? We hold on to that which was emphatic over and over again. Yahweh was with Joseph. That is what we treasure in this story. Yahweh was with Joseph through all of this. The fact that his brothers sold him, Yahweh was with him. The fact that he was purchased by a slave owner, Yahweh was with him. The fact that he was framed for doing the right thing, Yahweh was with him. The fact that he languished in prison for 13 years unjustly, Yahweh was with him. And when the opportunity came for him to have this position of influence, Yahweh was with him there too. And Joseph is doing his thing. He is working things out and he's doing what he can. And we do see a good result come out of this. The line of Israel is preserved. But to try to say that God orchestrated every move to get that to happen becomes problematic to hold on to. Now, oftentimes when we go through difficult things, we often can comfort ourselves and say, well, we know God is in control. And so for some reason, there must be some purpose behind why I'm going through this difficult situation. Or God must have a better plan or something, and he's just bringing me through this challenging time for now. And we can find comfort in those words. But the challenging thing with that is that when you think through the scenario necessary for that to happen, it becomes really centered on you more than what God is up to for all peoples. Because the narratives can't just overlap in a convenient and helpful way. Just like, okay, God saved Israel from the famine, but how many other people starved to death because of that same famine? One of the things we have to be careful about is using God's two get-out-of-jail-free cards. And what I mean by that is when we encounter a situation in life and we don't understand it and it doesn't make sense and it doesn't seem to fit what we understand to be the character of God, we play the first get-out-of-jail card, which is God moves in mysterious ways. And we make the assumption that we just can't understand everything that God is up to. And if we knew God's perspective, well, then we would understand. And there is truth to that. Don't get me wrong. But when we reach for that card because something is going on that doesn't fit what makes sense of the character of God, it allows God to get off. And all we left with is, I'm just going to trust God's doing something and God's making a plan for my life. But I think what we would have to say happens more often is life happens to us and God is with us as it happens. God isn't making this episode in life happen to us and therefore is doing something mysterious. But as we go through life and have these things happen, God is with us in the midst of that circumstance. The other get out of jail free card is the one that simply says, well, God can do anything. Because then when you encounter something that doesn't make sense or is inexplicable or doesn't follow rules of logic or whatever, you just say, oh, well, you know, God can do anything. And if you invoke that card, well, now you can't measure anything God does. Because God can do anything. If he's doing something that seems strange for his character, well, it just must be morally acceptable somehow. So God must have a good reason for letting people starve to death during a 7-year famine. But, you know, God's perfect, so it must be okay somehow. He works in mysterious ways. And how is it that he even brought this about? Well, God can do anything. Those two cards can leave us actually into a place where we don't have much to hold on to at all. So my encouragement this morning in this challenging sermon is for us to see in this story of Joseph what they are getting right about the nature of God and what, due to their ancient understanding of God, unfortunately led to a bit of a dead-end kind of resolution. To say that God orchestrated everything about the story of Joseph ends up bringing us into a cul-de-sac of reasoning that just keeps us going in circles. But if we hold on to the reality that in all of this, Yahweh was with Joseph, then we can recognize that Yahweh was also with his 10 brothers, that Yahweh was also with his younger brother Benjamin, that Yahweh was also with Israel in the first place, that God was actually with the Egyptians because the Egyptians benefited from Joseph's actions as well. The reality and the thing we hold on to is this: the divine presence is here. You cannot escape the presence of God. King David will say that later. Where can I go from your presence? If I go to the highest heights, you're there. If I go to the deepest depths, you're there. And what we treasure is the knowledge that no matter what we encounter, the good, the bad, and the ugly, God is present, and we can rest in the knowledge that through this, we will be carried because of God's faithfulness. That was Joseph's experience, and it was the Israelites' experience, and that's what we can take to heart today. Amen.